Welcome to a weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, boy, did we get some reaction from our episode last week and regarding Thomas Jefferson, whom Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School calls the monster of Monticello. Boy, oh boy, people love Thomas Jefferson, and we simply do not like to see our idols pulled down from their pedestals, and that's why we're talking to Paul. There are many different opinions about Thomas Jefferson, most of them very positive, but occasionally, as we discussed last time, we go beyond admiration and we engage in what I like to think of as founder worship. And if it's true of any of our founders, it's true of Jefferson. Probably Jefferson and Washington are the two we tend most to do that with. And Jefferson had his weaknesses. He was a human being just like any other. And so we've been discussing some of those. In fact, Paul is rather critical of Jefferson. He calls him somewhat creepy. And we spent a lot of time last time talking about Jefferson's relationship with the institution of slavery and with some of his individual slaves. We're going to pick up where we left off with Paul. And then after we finish our interview with Paul Finkelman, we have a special treat for you. We have the very first appeal of one of our quiz decisions. So stick around for that. But first of all, let's finish our discussion about Thomas Jefferson, the monster of Monticello.
As a member of the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, he proposes one bill which would have banned slavery in the Western territories. And people always point to this. Jefferson's anti-slavery. He wants to ban slavery in the Western territories. But he proposes that the ban take place in 1800, which is 16 years away. In the meantime, of course, thousands of slaves would have poured into the Western territories, Tennessee, Kentucky, the Ohio Valley. And by 1800, it seems unlikely you could have ended slavery. There'd be too many slaves. So he wants to end slavery in the future, where it isn't really very important yet. But he doesn't want to end it now, where it's not very important. It's all in the future. And that's the last time he will lift a finger to oppose slavery. When he is Secretary of State, he vigorously complains about a treaty with England known as the Jay Treaty. After the Revolution, the British agreed to return American property. And when the British leave, they take about 10,000 or 15,000 blacks with them who had been slaves. And the Americans say, we want our property back. And the British said, these are not property. These are people. These were soldiers. These are the wives and children of soldiers. They're not property. The Americans rant and rave that these are property. We want our slaves back. When John Jay negotiates a new treaty with Britain, the Jay Treaty,
1795.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Jay gets the British to say, we'll compensate you for the loss of your slaves because we understand that you think they're property. All right, we'll pay you off. It's just money. Jefferson's not satisfied with this. He wants the slaves. Hmm. He wants these black people to come back to Virginia. They've now been free since 1783, but he wants them back. He wants the bodies of these people. That's his position as Secretary of State. When he is president, well, let me back up a second. While he's vice president, and while he's Secretary of State and then vice president, there is the Haitian Revolution. Haitian Revolution.
That was a big deal. A lot of people are not aware of that. I mean, Haiti was overwhelmingly enslaved, and they didn't particularly like being slaves.
Yeah, probably 90% or close to it of the Haitians are slaves.
Right.
It's the only successful slave revolt in the history of the world.
Right.
They overthrow the French. They kick the French out. John Adams is on the verge of having diplomatic relations with Haiti when he's defeated for re-election in 1800. Jefferson takes office. The very first thing he does is to remove the American envoy from Haiti. He then asks for an embargo on Haitian trade two or three years before he asks for a similar embargo on trading with Europe during the Napoleonic Wars. His son-in-law, who is in Congress, and really speaks for his father-in-law, says that he is willing to spend America into bankruptcy to destroy the Black Republic.
Because the slave owners were scared to death of that example.
That's right.
I mean, they saw their own demise in Haiti.
That's right. And furthermore, he offers Napoleon a deal. If Napoleon will send an army into Haiti, Jefferson will sell Napoleon food. If Napoleon will send an army to Haiti to suppress the Haitian rebellion, Jefferson promises to sell Napoleon's army food, gunpowder, bullets, horses, whatever they need, so they don't have to have a supply line from France. It'll just be from the U.S. to Haiti. At the same time he does this, he's negotiating to buy New Orleans from Napoleon. Now, if Napoleon had successfully reimposed French rule on Haiti, he probably would not have sold us in Louisiana.
Because Jefferson was willing to give up Louisiana just to suppress the rebellion in Haiti.
Yeah. It's only after Napoleon's army is destroyed in Haiti, and a British army that's also sent there is destroyed in Haiti, that Napoleon sells Louisiana to the United States. Now, once we have Louisiana, Jefferson could have said, consistent with his own racist values even, he could have said, Louisiana's for white people. No slaves west of the Mississippi. We're going to end the march of slavery west. He doesn't do that. And when he leaves office, he gets a letter from his neighbor, Edward Coles, who had been James Madison's personal secretary. Coles says, I want to free my slaves. I don't own as many as Jefferson, but Coles was a wealthy young man with a substantial number of slaves. He said, I want to free my slaves. I'm going to take them to Illinois and free them where they can live as free people. And would you endorse me? Because I'm really doing this because I've read your Declaration of Independence. I've read you. I understand liberty. And Coles furthermore says, you know, you're not in public office anymore. You're no longer president. Wouldn't it be great if you endorsed some kind of abolition scheme? Well, Jefferson writes him a very long letter. The first two pages, he praises Coles. He says, I've been waiting for the generation raised on the mother's milk of liberty to come into power. And he ends the first section of the letter, about two-fifths of the letter. It's about two of five printed pages, with the words, the age of emancipation is upon us. Then he spends the next three printed pages telling Coles not to free his slaves. He says that...
This is a guy who wants to do it voluntarily.
Yeah, that's right. He says free blacks are pests on society. Mm. Pests, that's the word he uses. He says keep your patrimony, keep your inheritance. Don't free your slaves. It's a bad idea.
Wow.
During the debate over whether or not to admit Missouri into the Union...
Before we leave that, Paul, I believe you've told me that the last parts of that letter are not always included.
In 1944, I believe it is, I think it was Random House published a series of books called The Modern Library. And one of the Modern Library books was the collected letters and papers of Thomas Jefferson, a one-volume, easily accessible, not very expensive edition of Jefferson's letters and some of his other writings. And the editors, who included somebody who later became the editors of the collected papers of Thomas Jefferson, a man named William Peden, and a woman who taught at Smith, Adrian Koch, both very good historians, they cut off the last three-fifths of the letter. They ended it with the age of emancipation is upon us. So that if you read this book, you would have thought that Jefferson was endorsing freedom. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I was in college in the 1960s, I took a course where we used this book as a textbook, and I read this letter, and I believed that Jefferson had been endorsing private emancipation. And it was only a decade later that I found the full letter. So that for many, many Americans, this was the their view of Jefferson. And this
part
is
part of the mythologizing of Jefferson.
It's St. Thomas of Monticello. The guy, you know, you don't show this ugly stuff that you don't want people to know. So Jefferson is now in retirement. There's a debate over whether to allow Missouri to come into the Union as a slave or a free state, whether to split off Maine from Massachusetts to come in as a free state, whether to ban slavery west of the Mississippi. And the congressman from the Maine district, who will later be the first Maine congressman, writes Jefferson and asks him to endorse a ban on slavery in the West. And Jefferson writes back and says that he views this debate over slavery in the West as the death knell of the nation. And he said that the debate awoke him like a fire bell in the night. He also says in this letter that I've long since stopped reading the papers and don't follow public affairs, which is nonsense. Of course,
he devoured newspapers. Yeah,
he's totally involved in politics. And so he says that the people who are debating this will destroy America, which is the last great hope of mankind, and they will perpetrate treason against the hopes of mankind.
Wow.
Treason against the hopes of the world. It's, right. It's the last hope of mankind, and they will perpetrate treason against the hopes of the world. That's Jefferson's attitude. If you debate slavery, you are treasonous against America. While he is Secretary of State, he gets an almanac written by Benjamin Banneker, who's a black mathematician. Now, an almanac is a very sophisticated book that gives you high tide and low tide, full moon, etc., sunset for a particular region. And every coastal town has its own almanac because they all have different high and low tides. So Banneker sends Jefferson this almanac and for a town in Connecticut where Banneker lives, and Jefferson writes back and said, some years ago I wrote that I had doubts about the intelligence of your race. I'm so happy to see evidence that you're smart. It's a pretty arrogant, condescending letter. In one collection of Jefferson's letters by I believe he's deceased, but he's certainly no longer teaching, Merrill Peterson, the historian at University of Virginia, he has this letter in the book, and it says, homage to a black man. What he doesn't put in the book is a letter Jefferson writes some years later to a close political ally, in which he says that we all know that Banneker is a man with a very common mind, and we also all know that he probably didn't write his almanac, but his friend Ellicott, who's a white guy, who was always puffing him, wrote it.
Wow.
So that's the real Jefferson.
Wow.
Black men can't be good. At one point in his life, a man writes to Jefferson asking for advice on how to educate his kid, because in those days it was basically homeschooling. So Jefferson sends him lists of books to read, philosophy, history, music, literature, mathematics, science, and then at the end of the letter he says, but as for poetry, I really don't like it, and I don't understand it very well, and I can't give you any advice. But when he writes notes on the state of Virginia, he goes out of his way to say that the poetry of Phyllis Wheatley isn't any good. She's a black poet, very popular in England.
So he admits later he doesn't understand it, doesn't appreciate it, but goes out of his way to criticize it.
When a black woman writes it. Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
Now, let me talk about Sally for just a minute.
Sure.
Jefferson is married to a woman named Martha Wales Skelton. Martha Wales' first husband has died, so she's a widow. A young woman, very beautiful woman, neighbor of Jefferson. Her father, John Wales, is a rich planter. Jefferson marries Martha. They have a bunch of kids, one after another, and eventually she dies from complications of childbirth. Jefferson vows that he will never remarry, that he will never love again. And this is part of his notion of blacks, you know, that will remarry. They don't love the way I love. you know, here's this guy in his 40s and he's taking a vow, I could never marry again. Kind of foolish romanticism. Very few people take those kinds of vows. And the fact is that in the 18th century, most people lose a spouse. Mm-hmm. It's very rare to go through life without one of you. You know, Martha Washington is a widow when George marries her. People die, they get remarried. The spouse remarries. The dead person doesn't. So Jefferson says, I'll never remarry again. He takes his two daughters to France a few years after his wife dies. And then he has his overseers send him Sally Hemings to be a kind of maid in his French household. Her brother is already there learning how to be a French chef. Sally is the daughter of John Wales. That is, she is the daughter of the father of Jefferson's late wife.
They're half-sisters.
Yeah, yeah. John Wales, exactly. John Wales had a family with Mrs. Wales. When Mrs. Wales dies, John takes up with Betty Hemings, who is a slave, probably half-white. Might have been only she might have been three-quarters white. We don't know. Mm-hmm. She's at least half-white. And because Betty Hemings is the daughter of a white man as well. So Sally is at most one-quarter black. She might be only one-eighth black. She's, in other words, very fair-skinned. She probably looks a lot like his late wife since they have the same father. Probably when they're in France, Jefferson starts having a sexual relationship with Sally. Now, some people will jump over Jefferson. Oh, my God, you've got this guy. He's in his late 40s. He's having sex with a 15-year-old. That's pretty common in those days. Nobody in the late 18th century would have said, oh, this is morally wrong for a man of his age. Because, in fact, lots of men of Jefferson's age married women that young. So the age disparity can't be something we condemn Jefferson for. What is the substance of the relationship? Who knows? Maybe it's love. Maybe Sally, who's a young girl, is just overwhelmed and fascinated by this handsome, rich, powerful, smart, interesting guy. She's in love with Thomas Jefferson. He's tall, he's handsome, he's athletic, he's strong, he's rich. Maybe she says, this is the best I'm going to get in life and I better take it.
Right.
Maybe she says, this is a pretty good deal for me. I will always eat well and live well. I will get nice things. I'll get pretty dresses. And I can also help my brothers and sisters, who Jefferson also now owns.
Right.
Because he owns all of the Hemings slaves.
Right. And we have to acknowledge she didn't ultimately have any choice. I mean,
Well, again, we don't know what choice she had. It's
right.
possible that she could have said, I'm not going to do this with you. And Jefferson would have said, fine, you don't know what you're giving up. There are other slaves I could do this with.
Mm-hmm.
We do not know. He may have said, you do this or I will beat you and I will make your life miserable and I'll sell your brothers. We don't know. And I can't speculate. What we do know is that she has 5-6 children. The best evidence is that every one of these children is born 9 months after Thomas Jefferson is in close physical proximity to her, and that she never has children when she's not 9 months earlier in close proximity with Jefferson. We have at least one individual today who, from his own family traditions, claims to be a descendant of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, and DNA analysis shows that the Jefferson males carry a particular and very unusual, almost unique genetic marker. There are lots of Jefferson males through his two daughters. Their descendants. Their names aren't Jefferson, of course, because he only had daughters that survived to adulthood. But there are lots of heirs of Thomas Jefferson. All the male heirs of Jefferson have this marker, and so does this African-American guy.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Paul Finkelman, who's not a big fan of Thomas Jefferson. In fact, he's critical of a lot of things, perhaps especially Jefferson's attitude towards slavery. And we've just been discussing Jefferson's slave Sally Hemings and the rather overwhelming evidence that Jefferson fathered several children with her. After the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish up our discussion with Paul Finkelman. Stick around.
And here's to you, Mr. Jefferson. We all miss you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mr. Madison. Heaven help these fools that legislate. Rights away, our rights away.
So, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, Stuart, one of my favorite weekends is coming up.
What are your favorite weekends? What would that be?
It is the Wine Festival at Montpelier.
I can see why that would be among your favorites. Tell us, what is this Wine Festival? What do you do?
It's an event that's held annually at Montpelier. It's a time where folks come showcase various arts and crafts, food, vendors, live music, cooking with wine, but really you're coming to drink and taste wine from around the region.
And there are a lot of vineyards around here, aren't there?
There are a number of vineyards around here. It's a fun time. I always encourage any of my friends who want to come visit Montpelier, I give them all of the key vineyards to check while you're around here, because you can go see James Madison, get your history fix, and then go check out some of the vineyards. But on this day, they're coming to us, which is even better.
Oh, it is. It is even better. And I will emphasize that the last time I drove up to Montpelier quite recently, it's a beautiful day, and I had a guest with me. He'd not been here before. And we commented how many vineyard signs we passed. And he'd not been familiar with the fact that Virginia really has a long tradition of vineyards, and there are lots of really good wines around here. So it's primarily Virginia wines that are showcased?
Yep, primarily Virginia wines that will showcase. And there's actually, we haven't featured on our website, but you can also go to MontpelierWineFestival.com to learn more about the day. But it's Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th, 11 a.m. to essentially 6 p.m.
Saturday, May 4th, Sunday, May 5th, basically all day sort of thing. And is there an admission charge? Or?
There is. And if you buy your tickets online, it's cheaper. It's $15 in advance or $25 at the gate.
You can save $10 per ticket.
Yep. And there's a number of activities for children as well.
And what was the website they should go to again?
MontpelierWineFestival.com.
MontpelierWineFestival.com. Or, of course, they can always go to the basic Montpelier site.
Montpelier.org. And
Montpelier.org.
Link from there.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's continue our discussion with Professor Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School, all about Thomas Jefferson, the monster of Monticello.
There are three possibilities. Either is Jefferson is the father of Sally's kids, Jefferson's brother, or his uncle is. If you believe that Jefferson could not be the father of Sally's kids, then what you have to imagine is that Jefferson has been away from Monticello for a long period of time. He comes back, and he immediately calls his brother or his uncle and says, I'm here now, you can come over and sleep with Sally.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very likely.
So
the genetic evidence narrows it down to Jefferson, a male in Jefferson's generation.
And there are only three available.
Okay, but the other evidence strongly suggests, in addition to that DNA evidence, that it was Jefferson himself, and the alternate explanations are very unlikely.
Yeah. And the source of the accusation initially is a reporter named James Callender.
Right, whom Jefferson had hired.
Yeah, James Callender goes to jail under the Sedition Act of 1798 for criticizing John Adams. And after Jefferson gets elected president, he pardons Callender, and Callender asks for a job. He says, look, I went to jail for you. Give me a job. Jefferson hires him to do a little bit of sort of public relations, but then drops him, doesn't like Callender. Callender is not of his social class. Callender's a drinker. And Callender gets pretty angry at Jefferson. And he then starts working for the Federalists. And he makes a series of accusations of Jefferson. He accuses Jefferson first of hiring him secretly. Jefferson publicly denies this. Callender produces an uncashed check.
Yeah, if you're going to hire somebody secretly, don't use a check.
That's right. He accuses Jefferson of making an improper advance on his neighbor's wife when Jefferson was a young man, like 19 or 20. Jefferson denies this. He produces the letter of apology that Jefferson wrote them.
Oh, man.
He produces one after another. Each accusation, he's got the evidence. Mm-hmm. He accuses Jefferson of having a bunch of children, and then he has a retraction, says, I said he had this many children, and I think I'm not right about one of them. You know, Callender, in other words, turns out to be a very good investigative journalist.
I was thinking he was a pretty good journalist, yeah.
He's a pretty good journalist. And so that's the origin of the accusation. Now, here's my thoughts about this. Huge numbers of Southern masters have sex with their slaves. Masters in every slave culture on earth have sex with their slaves. All over the world, slave owning is combined with having sex with your slaves. Betty Hemings has sex with her owner. In the South, not every Southern slave owner has sex with his slaves. Some are married and are faithful. Some are not married and still don't have sex with their slaves. But it's pretty common. And it's not frowned upon the way we might wish it were. Certainly the wives of these men don't like it when their husband goes off to the slave quarters. There are many stories, plantation diaries of Southern wives, letters of Southern wives complaining about all the little mulatto kids who look like her husband running around the plantation.
Yeah, I would imagine the wives would not be happy about this.
But there's not a lot they can do, because they could sue for divorce for adultery, and it would be pretty hard to prove, since, of course, the slave woman can't be testifying.
Right, she can't testify. She can't.
So how are you going to prove it? There's no DNA testing. Mm-hmm. I have to live with it. It's not a pretty picture. Jefferson's a widower. He's a man who propositioned his neighbor's wife. He's a man who had one child after another with his wife. Clearly, he is not celibate. Mm-hmm. Clearly, he is not somebody who has a problem with sex. Sally is a young, presumably good-looking woman who reminds him of his wife because she's her half-sister. He probably had sex with her. Does that make him worse than any other slave owner in the South? Probably not. Does it make him like most other slave owners? Probably yes. I find it much less important than the fact that he sells nearly 100 slaves and ruins their
lives. That's true. Before we leave it, I think what makes it more compelling for a lot of people is the denial and the cover-up.
Yes.
I mean, this is a contemporaneous accusation, and it's backed up by all kinds of evidence. The Hemings family certainly has a long tradition of believing it's Jefferson descendants, and yet up to today, and certainly over the last 10 or 15 years, as the DNA evidence, the other evidence has piled up, there is still resistance
from
many quarters. And that's what I think people find really compelling.
It's just weird. I remember talking to somebody who was associated with Monticello in the 1990s, and I said to them, the evidence we have that John Wales is the father of Sally Hemings is reasonably compelling, and you at Monticello believe this to be true. And she said, yes. And I said, well, the evidence for Jefferson being the father of Sally's kids is exactly the same evidence. And she just looks at me and she says, well, we must give Mr. Jefferson the benefit of the doubt. This was before the DNA evidence. Why? That's not how historians operate. Historians operate on what kind of evidence do we have. The evidence on Jefferson and Sally is pretty compelling. I don't think it matters much. I think what's much more important is his public record in protecting slavery, his public record in refusing to do anything to hem in slavery, to reduce slavery in some ways.
Right.
I think that's much more damning for Jefferson's reputation. The fact that he is essentially pro-slavery, that he is deeply racist, that he invents scientific racism, I think that's the tragedy. Because here, after all, was a man who could have made a difference. What would have happened if Jefferson in the 1770s, after the Declaration is written, had gone back to Virginia and said, let's start gradual emancipation. It might take 100 years. We can do it more gradually in Pennsylvania. You know, let's make it so that that it's not the next generation, but the next generation we free. Let's do it way down the road. But let's make a start. Let's begin. Let's do something. In the 1790s, one of Jefferson's friends, who he will later appoint to be a U.S. district judge, a man named St. George Tucker,
yeah,
writes a 96-page proposal on how to end slavery in Virginia. It's very complicated. It would have ended slavery sometime in the 1950s, I think I once calculated.
Oh, really?
It would have taken forever. But the point is that right. Tucker's proposal was the beginning.
Right.
And Jefferson got a copy of it and didn't endorse it, didn't do anything with it, didn't propose it. Almost every one of Jefferson's non-Virginia contemporaries are members of anti-slavery societies. Some Virginians are. There's a lieutenant governor of Virginia who's a member of the Virginia Manumission Society. Jefferson never endorses any of this. He never endorses ending slavery anywhere.
And of course, one other person who was very anti-slavery was one of perhaps the most prominent correspondent that Jefferson ever had, and that was John Adams.
Yeah.
And Jefferson, I'm sure you've read the correspondence. What did he say about slavery to John Adams? I mean, didn't he acknowledge it at some point that it was a problem?
He acknowledges, look, when he's talking to people who are anti-slavery, he says, yeah, we got a problem. There's a wonderful example of this, a British friend. Jefferson talks about being a member of a republic of letters. He's writing people all over the world.
Right.
He's a great international intellectual. Writes to a friend in England and says, friend says, do you sell slaves? He says, I only sell slaves to reunite families. Well, that's a good thing, you know. My slave married your slave. I'll sell my slave to you, or you sell your slave to me so the couple can live together. He says, I only sell slaves to reunite families or for punishment. Well, the punishment is like draconian. It's the Stalinist knock on the door, as mm-hmm. you put it. But a couple of weeks later, or a couple of months later, I think it is, he writes his overseer in Virginia, sell some slaves, I need money.
That's another aspect of Jefferson's personality that I think, to the extent people have heard of it, they hear about it in the political arena, is that he was just very, very deceitful.
Yeah.
And he frequently would make one claim to someone's face and do the opposite. Now, you know,
look, politicians
do that all the time. It's just that we lionize Jefferson and we say that he's forthright. Well, no. I mean, he wasn't. He was a politician.
That's right. He's a politician. But here, this is his personal life. This is not politics. This is not Jefferson.
Well, he did it in both.
Yeah, but I'm saying this is not Jefferson. This is not the Speaker of the House of Representatives telling his Republican colleague, the governor of New Jersey, we will get aid for Hurricane Sandy on the table tomorrow, and then not doing it. I mean, I watched Governor Christie on the internet the other day, you know, just going on and on about how the Speaker of the House promised this, and he says, it's my party, and they were disgraceful. You know, Christie wasn't talking politics. He was saying New York, New Jersey, Connecticut are being badly treated. They are second-class states. It's not these congressmen from Lubbock who was just on publicly praising the government for giving aid to drought-stricken Lubbock and then voting against aid for Sandy. This is not politics. This is Thomas Jefferson writing a close friend and just plain lying to him about what he does, and then writing his overseer. So this is Jefferson. Now, the thing is, we have, as a country, invested a great deal in Thomas Jefferson. We really like the guy. He's really important.
He's got the best-looking monument in Washington, D.C.
I actually think the Lincoln Monument.
You like that one better?
Is equally as nice.
Uh-huh.
Maybe because the language on it isn't so duplicitous and dishonest.
Well, there you certainly have a point there. And as you've pointed out to me, certainly the epicenter of Jefferson worship is my son's college, the University of Virginia. And I think you mentioned to me something kind of fun, I thought was kind of funny, is that you'd spoken there, but you haven't been invited back in a few years, have you?
The last time I gave a talk at UVA, I am pretty sure, was in 1992 for the 250th anniversary of his birth, where I gave a paper on Jefferson and slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And UVA has not invited me back. Now, at the time, it was very funny. When I agreed to give the paper, I was teaching at Brooklyn Law School. But by the time I gave the paper, I had left Brooklyn Law School and become a professor of history at Virginia Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I gave this paper at UVA, somebody came up to me and said, "You just said those things because you teach at Tech." And I had just come to Virginia Tech, and I didn't understand the rivalry. And I just thought this was like, what are you talking about? And then I got back to Blacksburg,
uh-huh.
and the Roanoke Times, which is a local paper, has a headline in their Sunday section, art section, "Tech professor tackles top cavalier."
Thomas Jefferson has become a football rivalry.
Yeah, that's right. But the reality is that it's not about the football rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how do Americans come to terms with the world they live in. And this is why all this is important.
Right.
It's not about bashing Jefferson. Jefferson did some great things. Mm-hmm. We can thank him for the Declaration of Independence. I should add, by the way, that there's a famous myth about the Declaration of Independence. People think that Jefferson tried to end slavery in the Declaration of Independence.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah. In his first draft of the Declaration, he has a long paragraph attacking the king for supporting the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
Because Virginia had actually tried to end the African slave trade because they had too many slaves.
To their advantage, yeah, right.
That's right. And as a colony. And so he condemns the King of England for supporting the African slave trade. At the same time, he also condemns the British for enlisting slaves in the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people out there who think that what Jefferson was trying to do was end slavery in the Declaration. All he's doing is trying to blame slavery on the King of England.
Right.
They take it out because it's so patently absurd.
Right.
He does, however, leave in the Declaration a complaint that the British are using slaves to make war on masters. He doesn't use the term slave, but it's clear that's what he's talking
about.
Lots
of euphemisms.
Yeah. So, but we can thank him for, we hold these truths to be self-evident.
Sure, and religious freedom.
He favors religious freedom. He favors separation of church and state. He is a political philosopher of the Revolution. He's a leader of early America. He built a cool house in Virginia, which we can go
very into. Pretty house.
He helped plan the University of Virginia, one of the great universities in America.
There's that Louisiana thing.
Yeah, he bought Louisiana, although one presumes John Adams might have done that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem of America is, of course, the problem of race, the problem of slavery. We will ultimately sacrifice approximately 650,000 Americans between 1861 and 1865 to end slavery in this country. And perhaps that many more are permanently wounded and damaged. We will destroy billions of dollars worth of property, aside from the slave property that's destroyed.
Right.
We are still traumatized by the Civil War. We are still traumatized by slavery. Race is a problem in America because we cannot look in the mirror and face it. And as long as we live with these comfortable myths of Thomas Jefferson and the glorious founding fathers that were good masters, as the tourist at Monticello put it, we can't come to terms with our own modern world. And that's the tragedy. That's why Jefferson matters.
Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School, thank you so very, very much for telling us about the monster of Monticello.
You're welcome. It's a delight to be here, as always.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished our extended discussion with Professor Paul Finkelman all about what a headline writer at the New York Times called the monster of Monticello. Now, Paul was pretty critical of Thomas Jefferson, and I realize there are lots of you out there who are fans of Jefferson. I am, too, and even Paul recognizes that Jefferson made many positive contributions, but he was a human being after all. He was imperfect, and it's important that from time to time that we remember those things. But I'll be very happy in the future to talk to other people who have differing opinions about Jefferson, and if you have a differing opinion or if you have other evidence you want us to consider about these significant issues we've discussed, you know where to find us. Find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter. Or you can email us at ywc@montpelier.org. That's ywc@montpelier.org. And we'll be happy to consider your comments. Now let's go for something a little bit lighter. We have a real treat for you today. We have the first ever appeal of one of the decisions we made in a quiz that we actually did last year. And that's kind of fun. It's fun to think of you all out there playing along with our constitutional quiz. And it's fun to think that from time to time you disagree with us and maybe yell a little bit at the radio. And if you ever feel like we're really wrong, well, then you can do what Professor Jim Melcher has done. So let me explain. Several months ago, it was actually during our Osama bin Laden episode, you know, the one where I talked to John Bellinger about whether it was constitutional to kill Osama bin Laden. During that episode, we ran a quiz, and the quiz involved the 15th Amendment and involved four choices. And we had a really good discussion, and Kelly and I quizzed a fellow named Eric. And Eric, really smart fellow, knew lots about the law, had some really good reasoning. But ultimately, he hesitated between two answer choices and chose one that we were not looking for. He got the wrong answer, and so it was sort of disappointing, and Eric went away with only a pocket constitution and not a T-shirt, and we felt kind of bad for Eric, but someone else felt really bad for Eric. And this someone else is a professor from the University of Maine, and his name is Jim Melcher. And Jim Melcher did something that's not been done before on your weekly constitutional. He filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief. Basically, he said, you guys got it wrong. Eric, said Jim, was right, and here's why. And I was so impressed by his answer, and I called up Kelly, and Kelly and I said, you know, we really need to have Jim on, and we really need to let him make his case as to why Eric should have won. And so I guess this is really technically sort of a third-party appeal of one of our quiz answers. And just so that you'll be able to follow along with exactly what follows, here is the old quiz that we ran during the Osama bin Laden episode. Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz, and with me is Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, are you there?
I'm here, Stuart. Hello.
Tremendous. And we have also on the line Eric, our contestant. Where are you from?
Paris Mountain, South Carolina.
Tremendous. Well, Kelly, do you have a really tough question for Eric today?
I do, Eric. We're going to dive into an amendment in the Constitution today.
All righty.
I'm going to read you a portion of the 15th Amendment from the Constitution. And the question that goes along with that amendment is which of these principles, the principles which I will list of government, are reflected in the 15th Amendment. And your choice, answer choices will be judicial review, federalism, separation of powers, or popular sovereignty. All right, so here we go. The 15th Amendment, portions of it. The rights of citizens to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition or servitude.
Again, which of the principles that I'll list are reflected in the 15th Amendment? Is it judicial review, federalism, separation of powers, or popular sovereignty?
And what was the quoted language again?
Again, from the 15th Amendment portions of it, the rights of citizens to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition or servitude.
Servitude, right. Okay. Which of those four answer choices best reflects that language that Kelly quoted to you? So what do you think? Talk us through your reasoning.
Answer A, judicial review. Judicial review was not established in the Constitution, but through court decisions and precedent. So particularly the case Marbury versus Madison. So that would not be the correct answer.
Okay.
What was B?
B was federalism.
Let's come back to that one.
Okay.
And answer C?
Separation of powers.
Separation of powers is established in the Constitution through the structure of the Constitution, setting up the office of the presidency, the Congress, and the court system. So that would not be the correct answer. And answer D, popular sovereignty, would be more akin to the establishment of the Constitution itself, we the people, giving people the right to vote and the right to elect their own representatives. So I would say that answer B, federalism, has to be the correct answer.
Nope.
Because it was used to essentially reshape the United States and assert federal supremacy over the states in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Well, that's very interesting reasoning. Kelly, did Eric get things correct?
It's good reasoning, but I'll have to go back to your description of popular sovereignty, because you mentioned that popular sovereignty was originally established in the Constitution with we the people, but we the people, when the Constitution was written, left out a significant portion of people. So D is the correct answer for popular sovereignty.
Oh no. Oh, good heavens.
But your rationalization was right on.
You sounded so good, Eric. You sounded so good, right up to the point where you picked the wrong answer.
Not only that, Eric, but you gave us all a good lesson describing all of these important terms.
Yeah, I think the only thing I might quibble with, Eric, was that federalism is really more of a description of the relationship between the states on the one hand and the federal government on the other. And though that was certainly affected by the Civil War, and federal sovereignty, federal supremacy was sort of definitively established by the fact of the Union winning the Civil War, it was actually a concept that long predated it. It goes all the way back to Article 6 and the Supremacy Clause. So that's the reason that was not the correct answer with regard to the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment guaranteed voting rights to former slaves. And in that regard, it extended popular sovereignty to that group of people. So that's why I think that was a correct answer choice.
I'll go back and reread the 15th Amendment.
You're a good sport, Eric. Thank you for playing.
And now we're back, and now we're going to hear from Jim Melcher of the University of Maine as to why Kelly and I, and not Eric, got that quiz wrong. Jim, are you there?
I am here. I'm here in Farmington, Maine, at the University of Maine at Farmington.
I have to ask, whenever I speak to somebody from Maine, do you personally know Stephen King?
I do not, but I've been past his house. It is a marvelous place with a really, really imposing, frightening-looking fence. He's right in Bangor, but have not shaken his hand personally, and maybe I'm the safer for it.
I was thinking, yeah, if you shake his hand, I understand you die within 24 hours, so that's probably, or maybe you come back as sort of an undead person. I'm not sure.
No, it's okay, when you touch the key to your car, it becomes alive and becomes known as Christine, so it's got its own set of issues, that's right.
And Cujo's in the back seat, but we digress. All right. Okay, Jim.
Kudos to Cujo.
From the University of Maine at Farmington, now tell me why you think Eric was right and Kelly and I were wrong.
Well, there's a couple things. First off, this is clearly a matter of federalism. Federalism is laying out the powers of the national government relative to the states. And then as now, voting is primarily something that is given to the states. We see that different states have different voter registration laws. Different states have different hours for voting. Some states use presidential primaries, others use presidential caucuses, and for the most part, most matters concerning voting belong to the states. And the 15th Amendment takes that out of their hands to a large extent. Many states, even in the North, had been hesitant to allow African Americans to vote prior to the Civil War. And this steps in and reshapes the federal relationship by saying, well, we're going to mandate, the federal government's going to come up with a new rule that says you're going to have to change the way that you do that. So it's a large reshaping of the federal relationship. I can see why popular sovereignty
Hold it there. Before we get to popular sovereignty, I have to say that that is something that I think maybe in the back of my mind, I was maybe even thinking of during the quiz, because you're right. You're absolutely right. Voting, even to this day, is largely left to the states. And so this really was a shifting of the relationship between the federal government on the one side and the states on the other, specifically with regard to whether black men, African-American men, could vote, because, of course, women didn't come along. But I must say
they didn't come along in voting, but they had been some.
Excuse me. Exactly. Exactly. But I must say that the answer choice that Kelly and I were looking for, popular sovereignty, specifically deals with voting. Right, Kelly? I mean, isn't that's where we were coming from, right?
Absolutely.
Which is why, you know, I was figuring, okay, you know, federalism's not a bad answer, but a choice D, popular sovereignty, was a better answer. But I think you've got a reason for why that's not a good answer.
Well, voting, there's a couple of things. One, popular sovereignty in that era was largely talking about the question of allowing for a state to vote. You think of Stephen Douglas and his proposition that we should let every state decide who's allowed to whether you're going to have slavery or not have slavery. We'll let Kansas decide. We'll let Nebraska decide. We'll let whoever decide. And there, popular sovereignty is a doctrine that's giving more power to the states. In this case, popular sovereignty wouldn't seem to be doing that. It would seem to be going the other way. It's taking power away from the states and giving it to the national government. And more generally, popular sovereignty is about the statement that the people are where power belongs, as opposed to a particular definition of who the people are. So there are some pieces of popular sovereignty into it, but I think Stephen Douglas would shake his head at popular sovereignty being the explanation for the 15th Amendment.
Oh, man, Kelly, I think we've got a history professor on the phone line.
Or maybe a political science professor who teaches American political thought and thinks he knows his history.
Jeez Louise.
It's a good thing I don't have you all sitting listening to my lectures, because you'd be finding that I probably graded my students' exams wrong, and I'd have to buy him a T-shirt.
I think that's a good idea. Kelly,
or get on the pocket constitution.
We need to plant some spies in Jim's next poli-sci class and catch him.
How dare he challenge the quiz lady?
How dare he?
I know you haven't planted spies already.
Well, you don't. See, that's just the thing. You don't know.
Can't prove that negative, you know.
You don't know it. Well, Kelly, I don't know. I don't know about you, but I'm thinking that Jim is making a really good case. Now, I still think that popular sovereignty was a good answer. Just because of the generic idea that, you know, voting and popular sovereignty do go together. But, you know, I think Jim's got a really good case that federalism is at least as good an answer, and maybe in the historical context, arguably could edge it out. So what do you think? Should we grant this appeal? Should we give Eric a T-shirt?
I think the answer is yes, absolutely.
Oh, well, Jim, you have convinced the quiz. This is a first. You have convinced the quiz lady to give a T-shirt, despite the fact that we didn't get the answer we were looking for originally.
I really appreciated this conversation. For the record, I like that folks are challenging our quizzes a little bit.
I like that too. You know, the whole...
The whole conversations like these.
Yeah, I agree completely. The whole point of this program is to get people talking and thinking about the Constitution. So I really appreciate sending us the email and making your case, Jim.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a great show, and it was a lot of fun talking to you all today.
Well, you're not quite done yet, because I want you to tell everybody you actually use the show at least as extra credit in one of your classes, right?
Yes, I do. There are a number of I try and get my students to listen and explore the Constitution more deeply in my American government classes and my constitutional law classes, and the Bin Laden podcast was one of the ones that I have made available for extra credit to my students, and a few of them have checked it out and enjoyed it. So hopefully I've earned some good listeners for you up here in the wicked good state of Maine.
Well, we're so pleased by that. And I mean that in all seriousness. Now, clearly I use the show as an adjunct to my constitutional law class. In fact, I assign it. My students listen to it, and I actually will test them on it and make sure that they've listened. And I think, you know, I think it's valuable in that regard. But it pleases me enormously that other professors around the country or other teachers might be using it as well. And so I'd like to invite anybody, any teacher who is using this in class or in conjunction with a class or in a college course or a law school course, please do send us an email. Our email address is YWC at Montpelier, MONTPELIER.org. So it's YWC at Montpelier.org. And if you've been using it, and especially if you'd like to contest one of our quizzes or if you have an idea for a show, please do send us an email, and you can be the next Jim Melcher.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, that's a pretty big burden to put on people. I don't know.
Thanks for crawling in, Jim.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Now let's let Eric in on the good news. Hi, this is Stuart Harris calling for Eric.
Professor Harris, hi.
That's right. I'm calling from your weekly constitutional.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry I let you down on the quiz question that time.
Well, that's why I'm calling, because you see, Eric, you didn't.
Really?
You really didn't. In fact, I want to share with you the fact that a professor from Maine, from the University of Maine at Farmington, a political science professor by the name of Jim Melcher, was so upset by the fact that we didn't give you a T-shirt after your quiz that he wrote an entire appeal, sent it to us via email, and then demanded to come on the show and defend your answer and your honor.
My goodness, I'm dumbfounded.
Well, you shouldn't be, because he made very compelling arguments, and we decided, after discussing this at great length with Professor Melcher and with the quiz lady, that while we still think our answer was the one we're looking for and we still think it was correct, we think that yours was too.
Well, actually, now that you mention it, I did do some research on the 15th Amendment.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I did. And I tend to agree with Professor Melcher.
But you weren't angry enough to file your own appeal on your own behalf?
You know, I didn't think that it was governed under the system of appeals. I thought it was a game show.
Oh, absolutely. No. We have a board of appellate, quiz appeals here, and we always try to be very fair with people. And so, and I'll remind all disappointed quiz contestants of that fact. So if you come on the show and you don't get a T-shirt and you still think you're right, by golly, send us an email and try to tell us to come back, because not only did he file his appeal, but he won his appeal on your behalf. And so on that basis, you are going to get a YWC T-shirt.
I have coveted the T-shirt. I didn't earn it. I didn't feel I earned it, but I have coveted it.
Well, we're very happy about that, and we will send you one very shortly. And in fact, because we didn't give it to you in a timely fashion, we may even throw in a YWC baseball cap.
Oh, my. That, for Professor Melcher.
Oh, you want to argue on his behalf now? I guess we should send Melcher a T-shirt too, shouldn't we?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll send Melcher a shirt as well. Have the two of you been talking about this? Is this some sort of collusion going on here?
No, I haven't spoken with him.
All right. Well, I think that's a good idea too. We'll have to send Professor Melcher a T-shirt as well. So, congratulations, Eric, and your T-shirt is in the mail. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Professor Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School. Thanks also to Professor Jim Melcher of the University of Maine at Farmington. And, of course, to Eric von Kleist, our contestant who thought he'd lost, but then eventually got his T-shirt. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.